Thank you. Hello, may it please the court. My name is Audrey Bianco, registration number 37930, and I'm here today representing Ms. Dalton. The issues in this case, in my opinion, are inextricably intertwined, so for that reason, I'm intending to touch on both of them. But the essence of the case is this, that Ms. Dalton was found wandering around the streets of Fruita, shoeless despite the cold November temperatures, talking about oracles and famous movie stars and voices in her head. She believed she was asleep, that she had flown through the night and through the door of the car barn. She simply did not know what she was doing. She was immediately hospitalized by the police, and her insurance company paid for all the damage to the car barn. But the fact is, the prosecutor sought to convict Ms. Dalton for a felony, and because of that, the prosecutor sought to persuade the jury that Ms. Dalton acted knowingly to secure the conviction. She crossed the bounds of proper advocacy and filled in holes in her case with misleading statements about the law, incorrect statements about the facts, and appeals to the prejudices of the jury.
Ms. Bianco, let me ask you a question. Sorry to interrupt at this early stage, but you said that she, Ms. Dalton, believed that she was asleep. Is there any testimony from her or any other evidence about I was asleep when this occurred?
The evidence on that was actually from the police officer, Officer Peck, who said that when he encountered Ms. Dalton wandering around, when he spoke with her, one of the things that she said is, I thought I was asleep, that I've been asleep for months, I've been asleep for years, I made movies in my sleep. But she did say at one point, I was asleep and I was flying down the road and I flew through the big red door. And the big red door, he understood to be the door of the car barn. So, you know, when she testified, she did not remember the events of that night. But at the time, that is what she said to the police officer. And there's also the fact that her boyfriend testified he had given her two sleeping pills that night. So that also supports the conclusion that, you know, she was in some sort of stage between sleep and wakefulness, although we did not introduce any expert testimony regarding that.
Ms. Bianco, getting to not knowing what she was doing, getting to the mental state, didn't she say a little bit later that she was sick of life or something like that, suggesting that perhaps this was a suicide attempt or something along
right.
that line?
Yes, Your Honor, she did say that. She said it several days later after she had been heavily medicated. And even at that time, she didn't know what she was doing in the hospital. She had sort of a sketchy understanding of what was going on.
So sorry to interrupt, because I want to really get this clear. Was she referring to her actions when she drove through the red door, or was she referring to her situation at that point in her life?
I think that's not entirely clear. I will tell you in candor, my understanding was that she was referring to when she went through the red door, that she was sick of life, so she went through the red door.
So would that not support?
I think arguably that does support the conclusion of the jury. However, the standard for sufficiency of the evidence requires that there be more than a scintilla of evidence. The evidence has to be substantial and sufficient to support a conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt. And the fact is when reviewing that issue, you need to look at the totality of the evidence, not only the evidence introduced by the prosecution. And frankly, even the prosecution's evidence in this case. I mean, the first person to bring up Ms. Dalton's mental condition actually was the police officer who testified on behalf of the prosecution. But when you look at the...
That was Officer Peck.
Yes, exactly. The totality of the evidence in this case, when you look at all of it, even in the light most favorable to the prosecution, that one statement that she made at this later point in time when she was heavily medicated is not sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that when this happened, she knew what she...
But prior to that, she had driven a vehicle.
Yes.
6 or 9 miles, I don't remember what it was, from the,
right.
from their residence to this place of business.
Yes.
And I think the record also indicated that in crashing through the red door, there were other vehicles around that she missed. She didn't hit. Seemed to make a direct hit on the red door.
That's correct, Your Honor. I guess I have a couple of different thoughts about that. I mean, first of all, she wasn't charged with any offense committed during those miles of travel. She was charged with going through the red door. And the fact is that, you know, this court has held on previous occasions that someone's mental state can change within a very short amount of time. So the prosecution wasn't required to show that she knew what she was doing during that drive. It was required to show that she knew what she was doing when she crashed through the door. And she testified, or she, I guess, told Officer Peck that when she drove through the red door, she thought she was asleep and she thought she was flying. So the fact that she made all those turns, frankly, go to her mental state perhaps at an earlier point in the evening, but not at the point of the crash. Furthermore, I think that sort of in common knowledge, we know that people can do a great number of things without fully being aware of doing them, and that those things include doing things in their sleep. So, you know, the evidence was clear that she had taken a lot of sleeping medication, that she believed she was asleep. So even if she was able to drive her car, that doesn't actually prove that she knew she was actually driving, and not that she was believed herself to be dreaming while she was driving, if that makes sense. I mean, I think that really what these issues of sufficiency get to is the fact that that's why I know this court hears arguments about prosecutorial misconduct all the time. And very often you find that they're harmless and probably, you know, rightly so. But in this case, because there was so little evidence, the prosecutor used misconduct and inept analogies and misstatements of the facts to persuade the jury that they had met their burden and to convict her. And I think that really you have to look at the two pieces together, that I don't believe this jury would have convicted Ms. Dalton had they not been told that they could consider her decision-making process when she stopped taking her medication, had they not been told that, you know, she was wasting her money on frivolous things like cigarettes instead of paying to take her medication. And they were told by the prosecutor that they could use that information to conclude that she knew what she was doing that for this crime.
Let me ask you a series of questions. I think the answer to each one could be yes or no.
Okay.
Was the jury given an instruction that her act has to be voluntary?
Yes.
Did the instruction say that the act performed had to be performed consciously as a result of effort or determination?
I believe that was the definition of voluntary.
And the instructions are not on the record for some reason, apparently.
I believe they are. If you want, I can grab them.
That's all right. There was evidence that the defendant acted unconsciously or in her sleep through the testimony of Officer Peck.
Yes.
But there was contrary evidence that she acted consciously, the evidence that Judge Hawthorne just pointed out.
Yes.
So isn't it up to the jury to weigh that evidence and decide whether there's sufficient evidence on either side?
Yes, Your Honor. Generally, it is up to the jury to weigh that. And that is why one of the reasons why I feel that this court can't ignore what the prosecutor told the jury they could consider. The fact is this prosecutor told the jury they could consider Ms. Dalton to have acted like someone with epilepsy who, with a history of epileptic seizures, made a conscious decision to stop taking her medication, and that she, despite her seizures, chose to get in a car and drive. That analogy is inapt. Sorry.
I'm sorry to interrupt you here, it sounds like you're saying that perhaps conceding that there was sufficient evidence, but that evidence was irreparably tainted by the prosecution's misconduct.
No, actually, I mean, Your Honor, respectfully, I'm not conceding that there was sufficient evidence, but I am arguing that even if you conclude that there was sufficient evidence in this case, Ms. Dalton is entitled to a new trial at a minimum, because the evidence in this case was so weak, I would argue insufficient. But even if you conclude that it was sufficient, that this prosecutorial misconduct really tipped the scales. This was simply an unfair trial, because the fact of the matter is Ms. Dalton had no history of having psychotic breaks. She had no way of knowing that if she stopped taking her medication, she would have such a break.
She had stopped taking the medication months before this incident.
Yes, she had. But that was one of the prosecutor's arguments, was that...
Was there an objection to that hypothetical being laid out in the voir dire?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't.
And no objection in the closing argument?
No, Your Honor.
So we have to review this for plain error.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, I say absolutely often you don't find plain error in this type of situation. But in this case, the law is very clear. The prosecutor can't make these sorts of arguments. It's common sense that the prosecutor can't make some of these arguments. And,
sorry to interrupt. You're talking about these pre-commitment kind of voir dire and then later similar arguments at closing. Is that... these kinds of arguments, is that what you're referring to?
Well, I'm referring to that, but I am also referring to this sort of misstatement of the law. The fact is that...
We're focusing the jury on the knowing based on what she did months before.
Right, and giving this analogy that was inapt based on the evidence that was presented, telling the jury they could convict her based on something that was simply not a correct statement of the evidence or the law. And, you know, I think...
Was that obvious?
I think it was quite obvious. The fact is that, you know, well... The fact is that the law is very clear that the jury has to be properly instructed on the law. I think everybody would agree with that.
But you're not challenging that.
I'm not challenging the instructions, but what I would say is that the prosecutor was offering essentially an additional erroneous instruction to the jury. And that when the prosecutor did that, the court had the obligation and should have been aware enough to say, you know, that is an incorrect statement of the law, counsel. You know, the jury will disregard that. And that did not happen here.
Was that argument made in the opening closing or in the rebuttal closing?
Both, I believe, Your Honor.
Was any response made by defense counsel saying this is not an epileptic case? This is a case where the lady had no idea what was going to happen.
I think that that the defense counsel did essentially argue that this was a case where she didn't know what was going on. And frankly, I can't offer an explanation for all the defense counsel's actions in this case. I would just, you know, suggest that just as this court doesn't reverse to punish prosecutors, that you shouldn't affirm in order to punish defense counsel who acted deficiently, which I think is probably what happened in this case, in all candor. But if possible, I'd like to save the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Carmen Moraleda, and I represent the people in this matter. My attorney registration number is 34852. So I would like to, in presenting my argument, respond to your questions. First of all, as to the sufficiency of the evidence, as this court is well aware, in a sufficiency standard, this court does not weigh the evidence. It just looks at all the evidence of guilt that is in the record as a whole and in the light most favorable to the prosecution to determine whether any rational fact finder could have found all the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt.
Is a modicum of the evidence enough?
No. But in this case...
Is I'm sick of life anything more than a modicum of evidence?
There is much more evidence than just that, and I will answer your question right now. So here, with all the evidence presented, any rational fact finder could have found the defendant acted knowingly when she drove through the car. And this is the evidence that was introduced at trial. First of all, she defendant got in the car at approximately 3 a.m. in the morning. 7 to 8 hours had elapsed since she took the sleeping pills. The boyfriend testified that he had given her the pills at around 7 to 8 at night, and it was like 2:30 to 3 when she got in the car. So 7 to 8 hours had elapsed since she took those pills. Then she drove 4 to 5 miles on the dirt curvy road at night. She drove an additional 4 to 5 miles on the paved road. She had to turn her car off the road to get to the car barn. And she had to slam on the accelerator to go all the way through the garage door and into the lot to cause the damage that she caused.
Is this all the testimony of Officer Peck?
No, this is also based on the testimony of the boyfriend, I believe.
Well, the first part's about the boyfriend, but yeah. In terms of the distance she drove, and the notion that she turned off the road and accelerated into the car barn, that we would find, you say, in Officer Peck's testimony?
So the way that she had to slam on the accelerator is based on the Officer Peck's testimony. He also testified that this crash was not a traffic accident, that it was an intentional act. There were no skid marks or anything like that, so clearly was not an accident. And as you had mentioned, defendant told the officer this was, I believe, 2 weeks after the incident that she drove through the door because she was sick of life. Now, there's like a subtlety. When she spoke with the officer right after the accident, she told the officer that she drove, that she believed she was in a dream, and she just drove, not fly, through the door. The flying against warding was used by defendant at trial, and that's something that the prosecution in this case pointed out. She was just talking about driving, and then at trial she used the word fly through the door. So with that evidence, as the prosecution argued, you just don't accomplish all those actions of driving at night for all those miles on a difficult road without knowing what you're doing. You can't do all those things without being aware what you're doing. We're talking about driving. We're not talking about sleepwalking. And in fact, the prosecution's theory is that not only did she know what she was doing, it was her specific intent. That was her goal, to go through the red door.
Well, sorry to interrupt. Yes. You're focusing us on the mental state knowing consistent with the act of driving into the red door. But the district attorney focused the jury on a knowing as far as other facts. So, I mean, opposing counsel has said these two issues are intertwined. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about that? And Dalton knows that she's supposed to be on medication, oh. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. There's a lot of knowledge unrelated to the crime.
Yes, Your Honor. So first of all the prosecutorial misconduct claims that are raised occur in rebuttal. Okay, if you read the initial closing argument of the prosecution, is essentially based on her awareness, why she was aware, what she did, the distance she drove, all the things she had to do to get the car going, all the decisions she had to make. The only time when the prosecution then started talking about the medication and the things she was supposed to do, that occurred in rebuttal. And the reason, the way I read it, and is, this court is where you have to read the closing argument as a whole. You can read just a specific challenge argument in isolation. The defendant's theory of defense was that, she didn't know what she was doing, and that her mental state had deteriorated like a month prior to the incident and all the way to November 2nd when this incident occurred. Talk about deterioration, you talk about the fact that she was forced off the medication, she couldn't afford medication, Medicaid wouldn't pay. And I believe that is in rebuttal when the prosecution said, well, that's all very well, but we are accountable for the decisions we make. She knew she was supposed to be on medication. She stopped taking the medication. She didn't seek help, she didn't reach out. And I think that was just a way, it was a proper response to the defense opening salvo.
Well, sorry to interrupt again, but that was also the statements made, or consistent, made during the voir dire at the beginning of the trial.
Yes, and are you talking about the seizure hypothetical?
Yes.
I think the only point that the prosecution was trying to make is, and I think that was proper in response to what was going to be the defense of the case, it's just we are accountable, personally accountable, for the decisions we make. The prosecution never said that defendant was guilty of the crime because she was supposed to be on medication and she did not take the medication, and therefore, as a result of not taking the medication, she ended up having this alleged psychotic episode. We don't know what was, because there was no expert testimony, and therefore, she's guilty.
Doesn't that hypothetical suggest what you just said? I mean, we know that if a person takes medication or gets drunk and drives, they're still responsible. We know from the epileptic cases, mm-hmm. if a person's supposed to be on medication, and they don't take it on that instance, and that caused them to black out, again, they're responsible. But this case is different from both of those hypotheticals. This is a case where long before she stopped taking the medication, and the problems had built up over time. It wasn't like on this instant she didn't take her medication. So the hypothetical about the epileptic really doesn't fit these facts, does it?
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't. I think the only point the prosecution was trying to make is like, We are responsible for the decisions we make. And as I said, the theory of the prosecution's case was not that she was guilty because she knowingly stopped taking medication and she was aware that she could have certain side effects. That was not. You have to read the whole closing argument to actually get the point. I mean, it's all across the board. The point was she's guilty because she committed the act and she knew what she was doing. And not only did she know, that was her specific intent. Any other questions as to the sufficiency of the... Just a few, I would like to make a few points on the closing arguments. As I said, this court is reviewing for plain error, and all the alleged prosecutorial misconduct happened during the rebuttal closing argument. And this court knows that the prosecution is given extra leeway to respond to opposing counsel's opening salvo. So none of the claims that defendant raises on appeal raise to the level of plain error. Neither the one about the stakeout questions or the ones about the comments on the choices that defendant made or the comments reflecting on defendant's socioeconomic status. Nothing raised, even if improper, which I'm not saying it was improper, it was not improper, none of them raised to the level of plain error that requires reversal of the convictions. So unless this court has any other questions, I'll be happy.
Let me break that down. I think you said that it was fair rebuttal by the prosecutor to talk about the fact that she used money to buy cigarettes and didn't buy her medication because there was something that the defense counsel said in his or her closing that erased that. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, actually, as to the defendant's choices, that was proper because it was based on defendant's testimony. And as this court knows, the prosecution can comment on the evidence submitted at trial and on the reasonable inferences.
Okay. So the defendant's testimony was seeking juror, I call it sympathy, for lack of a better word, for inability to take the medication.
Mm-hmm.
And the prosecutor's responding to that and saying she could have taken her medication. Okay.
Exactly.
So it wasn't a response to the defense counsel's closing?
Not that specific comment. I think my point about the seizure hypothetical, at the end of the opening salvo of defense counsel, he talked about how defendant's mental health deteriorated a month prior to the incident. And then in a clear reference to the testimony about how she could no longer afford the medication because Medicaid would not cover it. So I think it was just a fair game for the prosecution to try to rebut and say, that's all very sad, but still we are responsible for the decisions we make.
Okay, let's turn to the second one, the hypothetical about, I'll call the epileptic hypothetical, that a person's still responsible if they make a conscious decision not to take their medication. Again, that was only raised in the rebuttal by the prosecution. What was anything like that or in response to that said by the defense counsel in his or her closing?
Talking about the hypothetical?
Yeah, there's no.
No, he didn't. No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
So I think this is a quote from the prosecutor's rebuttal.
Okay.
And we talked about that, and this is quoted, talked about that in jury selection. We talked about the person who has a seizure disorder who decides to go off their medication. That person who then has seizures over the next months gets in their car, drives, and causes a wreck. That person, you said, was accountable unanimously. Everyone said that person is accountable for their actions.
Mm-hmm. As I said, I think that the point we're trying to make is this, you can't justify your action based on that. I don't think the prosecution meant you were criminally, like in this case, extrapolate. You were criminally responsible in this case because you were supposed to take medication, you stopped taking medication, you knew there were going to be some side effects, and despite of that, you decided to drive. If at all, I mean, it was, again, this court is reviewing for plain error. I don't see the harm because we don't have a seizure kind of scenario in this case.
Well, I think it's getting to this notion of a pre-commitment question that starts at the voir dire stage.
Okay. Would you like me to address that?
Sure.
About the pre-commitment. So pre-commitment questions are those that ask jurors to speculate or to pre-commit to how they would vote on specific facts. And most of the cases, there are no published Colorado cases addressing that issue. Most of the out-of-state cases have addressed that issue, and they have done so in the context of capital cases directed at determining the death penalty bias for the juror, where counsel, and in those cases was actually defense counsel, sought to ask questions regarding the juror's predisposition to the death penalty. So even if this court were to conclude that that kind of questioning is somehow improper, because it's due review for plain error, that cannot raise to that level of error, because again, we don't have, there's no law in Colorado, and even those cases out of the state that have addressed the issue, there's a lack of definitional criteria and agreement on the proper meaning and scope of stakeout questions. So unless the court has any other questions, I'll be happy to address. The people respectfully request that this court affirm defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, first I would like to address sort of a factual record issue that came up during the Attorney General's argument, which is the contention that all of these arguments to which we are objecting occurred only in rebuttal closing, and that's just simply not the case. First of all, and perhaps the most important, I will read it to you. During initial closing, the district attorney said to the jury, "Can you get help? Sure. Reach out. Can you take medications? Sure. Take your prescribed meds. Don't decide for 3 months that you're not going to take your medication, and we'll come back to that later." Now, I would propose to you that then she did in fact come back to it later in rebuttal closing. Nowhere that I could find in defense counsel's closing did he suggest that because Medicaid hadn't paid for her medications, she was not responsible for what happened. That was not the argument. That was part of the res geste of the entire incident, but it was not the argument. The argument was simply that for whatever reason, I mean, it is not clear that it was because of the ceasing medication that Ms. Dalton was in this condition. For whatever reason, she didn't know what was going on. And there were a number of different factors that were arguably part of that. The district attorney also made several comments during the initial closing saying, you know, could she dress herself? Yes. Could she eat? Yes. Could she smoke? Yes. Those are all the same things that we're arguing about that were then redoubled in rebuttal closing. The other thing I guess I would say is about these pre-commitment questions. There's a few things. I mean, first of all, there are cases in Colorado that say that no party can use voir dire to try and instruct the jury in the law or the facts of the case. Those are Liebarger and Shipman. So the prosecutor's questions were improper for that reason alone. But there's also, you know, extensive case law in the 10th Circuit and even from, you know, from all over the country that say that these sorts of pre-commitment questions are improper. And the Attorney General is correct. Usually those are the defense counsel who are attempting to pre-commit the jury to say that under some circumstance they would be willing to vote against the death penalty, and those have been held improper. But they're just as improper when a prosecutor uses those arguments to try and commit a jury to convict.
So based on that, it should have been obvious to the trial judge?
Well, at a minimum, it was obvious because it was an attempt to educate the jury on the law. And that very much is plain. I think that the case law is so extensive, and it's even in the treatises that say you can't do these sorts of pre-commitment questions, that the principle, I think, is obvious, even if there is no Colorado case on point saying that exact thing. And frankly, I mean, the United States Supreme Court has said you can't have a fair trial in front of a jury that's been organized to convict. And that's what this was. And to the extent there was any question about what this was, the prosecutor made it very clear in rebuttal closing when she came back to the point and said, "You all agreed, every one of you agreed, that this person should be held accountable." And that brings me to my last point, which is, to whatever extent the Attorney General is parsing accountability, this was a criminal case, a criminal trial. The goal was to hold my client criminally accountable. So for those reasons, we would respectfully ask you to vacate Ms. Dalton's conviction or, in the alternative, reverse for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you both for your excellent arguments. Those arguments are going to be very helpful to the court in reaching a decision in this case. And the matter will now stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. That concludes.